Let's talk this through. I've heard enough talk, General, I said. Shin is right. You're supposed to be leading us into battle and inspiring us, not dumping all your own fear on us. My accusation seemed to detonate on his face like a bomb. His features began to contort, but I turned my back on him so I wouldn't have to see the rest of his reaction. I walked out of there as fast as I could, without looking back. When I finally stopped walking a few minutes later, I realized I was lost. So I pulled up the interactive map of the base on my QCOM and used it to locate the nearest turbo elevator. I rode it down to the habitation level and then returned to where the living quarters were located. When I reached my room, I pressed my palm to the onyx panel beside the door and it slid open. The lights came on as I stepped inside. The interior looked like a dorm room at Starfleet Academy. It had a symmetrical two-occupant layout with a loft bed on either side, each enclosed in a transparent soundproofed box that could be blacked out with the touch of a button for privacy. Each loft also had a built-in ladder, dresser, and uniform closet, and there was a large, flat-screen television monitor embedded in the ceiling directly over each bed. There was also a small computer hutch beneath each bunk, with an ergonomic chair bolted to the floor. My backpack was sitting nearby. I sat down at the computer, and its built-in monitor lit up, displaying a desktop with EDA logo wallpaper and a few program icons. I took out the flash drive my father had given me and plugged it in. I held my breath as the file list popped up. There were hundreds of text files saved on the drive, along with dozens of video files, all with similar file names. Dear Zach, followed by a 6-digit numerical date. The first file was named Dear Zach 100900.txt, October 9th, 2000, a few days after my father was supposed to have died. Dear Zach, I'm not even sure how to start this letter. So much has happened in the past few days, and most of it still doesn't seem real. I'm writing you this letter from the moon. For real, kiddo, your dad is on the moon. You see, I didn't really die in an explosion at the plant like they told you and your mom. The government just made it look like I had died, because they need my help to fend off an alien invasion. I know that sounds ridiculous, like something out of a science fiction paperback or a late-night movie, but there's a reason for that. Star Wars, Star Trek, all of those sci-fi movies, novels, TV shows, and video games I've been playing my whole life, they were all designed to prepare the people of the world for a real alien invasion. I'm still trying to wrap my head around it, but I know it's true. I've already seen the evidence with my own eyes. We still don't know when the invasion will begin, so I'm not sure how long I'll have to be away from you and your mom. Maybe it will only be a few months. But it could be years before I'm able to come back home. There's also a chance I might get killed up here. If that happens, I don't want you to spend the rest of your life believing your dad was just some loser sewage worker who died in a stupid accident before he ever did anything important with his life. I want you to know who I really was and what really happened to me. But more than anything, I need you to know how hard it was for me to leave you and your mom, and how hard it is now to know you both think I'm dead. Please know that I never would have put either of you through all of this if I felt like there was any other choice. The government has promised to take care of my family while I'm away. They set up some sort of fake settlement for the accident, so you and Mom should never have to worry about money. You'll be able to live a lot more comfortably than the three of us ever could have on a sewage worker's salary, that's for sure. I know it won't make up for me being gone, but it does make me feel a little better. I really miss both of you, but I have to admit that it's also kind of amazing up here. My whole life I felt like I was destined to do something important, but I was only ever good at video games, which I always figured would be completely useless. But it's not useless, and neither am I. I think this is what I was always destined to do with my life. I just never knew it. My whole existence is classified now, so I'm not even allowed to send you birthday cards while I'm away. but I'm still going to write you as often as I can, and I'll save the letters until I can give them to you. I'm going to write your mom, too. It's only been a few days, but I already miss both of you a lot. I hope you're both doing okay, and I hope my funeral wasn't too hard on your mom or you, even though you're not even a year old yet, so you won't remember being there. But she will, and thinking about how hard that must have been for her makes me feel like jumping off a cliff. Of course, I realize now I already jumped. That's why I'm stuck up here now. Anyway, I promise to write again soon, when I have more time. I'll tell you about everything that has happened to me, and all about this moon base where I live. But right now, I have to go defend Earth from alien invaders. Love, Xavier, your dad. I kept on reading, devouring letter after letter. His early letters filled in missing details of the story I'd already pieced together from reading his old theory notebook. My father described in detail how he'd begun to uncover facets of the EDA's grand conspiracy in the years before they recruited him, after his encounter with the strange Phaeton game at his local arcade. He would later learn that the same prototype was used to recruit Shin, Graham, and Admiral Vance. After he was inducted, my father's longtime suspicions were confirmed. The EDA had been tracking him ever since he was in grade school. He'd been moved to the top of their watch list after he'd mailed in dozens of fuzzy Polaroids of his record-high scores to Activision. But the EDA deemed him ineligible for early recruitment due to some, quote, troubling results in the preliminary psych evaluation they did on him. That was why they didn't actually recruit my father until much later, when he was 19, shortly after he became a father. One morning, two men in black suits showed up during his lunch break and abducted him from his job. They took him to one of their secret installations and showed him an earlier version of the EDA briefing film I'd been shown, and gave him a choice. He could either join the EDA and use his video game skills to try to help save humanity, or he could, as he said, puss out and keep wading through sewage for a living until aliens show up and destroy our planet, along with my wife, my baby boy, and everyone else I know and love. What choice did I have, Zach? I didn't want to leave you two, but I couldn't just sit around and do nothing while that happened. So I said yes, even though I knew it meant I might never see you and your mother again. If I died protecting the two of you and our home, then I figured it would be worth it. Imprisonment. That was what he began to call it. In every letter I opened, my father repeated the same apologies, marking and lamenting every single missed birthday or Christmas. For him, every milestone of my childhood and adolescence had been a double-edged sword. Watching me grow to manhood brought him joy, even from such a great distance, but that joy was always tinged with the bitter agony he felt at having missed every last second of it, and the knowledge of the pain caused by his absence. Once a month, he wrote, the EDA would send him updates about my mother and me. He looked forward to them like holidays. In the interim, he scoured the internet for any additional scrap of news about us he could find in a local paper or on my school's website. Every time he received a new photo of me, he wrote about it in his letters in endless detail, going on and on about how big I was getting, about how much he'd missed me and my mom more and more every year. He wrote to me about his day-to-day life as an elite Moonbase Alpha drone pilot. He recounted the details of the battles he fought each year during the Jovian opposition. He wrote about his hopes for victory and about his fear of the coming war. My father used that phrase often in his letters. The coming war. It made me realize how terrible it must have been for him to have this conflict hanging over his head all these years. He had lived his whole adult life with this terrible burden, knowing that the end of everything was coming and that it was drawing closer every second. In one letter, he confessed that he'd stopped dreading the coming invasion. Now I long for it to begin, he wrote, because, one way or another, it will put an end to my misery and my imprisonment here. He wrote, I miss you and your mother so much. I can barely stand it sometimes. And then, half a dozen letters later, he wrote, I just can't stand it anymore. Another letter said he'd gone a little nuts for a while. He wrote about how they put him on antidepressants. When things got really bad, he took tranquilizers sometimes, too. And he was required to video conference with a shrink back on Earth twice a week. He wrote that they kept giving him medals, but they no longer meant anything to him. He just wanted to go home. But he couldn't, because it was his job to make sure humanity still had a home when this was all over. Besides, he knew the EDA wouldn't let him go home now anyway, because he'd asked them repeatedly. But they told him he was far too valuable an asset, and that the world needed him right where he was. So instead, he'd started to beg the EDA to give him just a few hours of shore leave so he could visit his family and remember what it was he was up here fighting for. They told him that would be too big of a security risk, and that if anyone learned he was still alive, especially his family, it could jeopardize everything he had worked for and sacrificed for all of these years. As difficult as it had been for me to grow up without knowing my father, I now realized that the years we'd spent apart had been even more difficult for him. For the past 17 years, I'd been living an idyllic life in the suburbs with Mom, surrounded by friends and all the comforts of home. My father had spent those years here, in this desolate place on the far side of the moon, all alone, and for all he knew, completely forgotten by his loved ones. Finally, I got curious and jumped ahead to the collection of video messages he'd recorded. I clicked on the most recent one, dated less than a week ago. The timestamp said it was just after 2 o'clock in the morning by MBA time. My father was sitting in a large, dark room, larger than his quarters. It was some part of the base I didn't recognize. His unshaven face was just inches from his QCOM, and his paranoid, bloodshot eyes filled half of the video frame. As he sat there, in the dark, rambling into his QCOM's video camera, he looked and sounded just like a raving, straight-jacketed asylum patient. More specifically, a lot like Brad Pitt in 12 Monkeys. "There's something I have to do," he said. "Something I can't tell you about until I see you in person, but I don't know if Vance will really honor my request and station you up here with me. If he doesn't, I need you to know something." He stared into the camera lens, seeming to search for the right words. "What if figuring out the aliens' true motives is the only way to beat them?" He shrugged and glanced away. "Or at least survive them? At this point, I think surviving might be humanity's best-case scenario." He looked back into the lens. "I hope all of this makes sense to you, if and when you actually ever get to see it. If you do, please forgive me, son, for everything. And no matter what people call me, no matter what they say about my own actions, I want you to know that I did what I felt I had to do to protect you and your mom and everyone else back on Earth. Please know that I did what I did because I didn't think I had any other choice. If you're still alive to see this message, you'll know I made the right one." He stared expectantly at the camera for a few more seconds, as if he actually expected someone to respond. Then he tapped the screen in front of him, and his image winked out. I yanked out the flash drive and pocketed it. Then I knelt to grab my EDA rucksack. My old canvas backpack was stuffed inside, along with my father's old patch-covered leather jacket. I slung the pack over my shoulder, then continued out the exit. I walked down the empty corridor to my father's quarters. The door hissed open for me automatically as soon as I came within range of its retinal scanner, and I saw my father sitting in a chair in the corner of the room, strapped into an Armada interceptor flight control system like the one I had at home. He was wearing VR goggles and a pair of noise-canceling headphones and didn't appear to notice me come in. I could tell that he was playing an Armada practice mission with Shin and Milo because he kept saying their call signs, followed by his trademark red drive catchphrase, which he uttered each time he blasted one of his opponent's ships to virtual smithereens. "You're welcome, you're welcome, oh, and you're quite welcome, too." I cleared my throat loudly, and he pulled off his goggles and headphones. I held up his flash drive. He nodded and stood up. Then He glanced over his shoulder at the nearest security camera before turning back to me. "Let's go," he said. "I know a place we can talk in private." 18. My father led me through a maze of dimly lit corridors, then onto a turbo elevator. It whisked us upward to the base's top level, and the doors opened onto the observation deck. I now noticed that the transparent dome overhead was the exact same size as the domed ceiling down in the Thunderdome, and it offered the exact same view. I glanced around until I located the camera array suspended from the dome's armored frame, which captured the 360-degree view of the surrounding landscape in high definition and projected it onto the Thunderdome's concrete ceiling, deep beneath the moon's rocky mantle. Without pausing to admire the view, my father crossed to the other side of the observation deck to another elevator door. Unlike the other doors on the base, this one failed to open automatically when he approached it. Instead, he flipped open a panel beside it to reveal a numeric keypad and punched in a long code from memory. The doors swished open, and we stepped inside. There was a single button with a down arrow on it that lit up when my father pressed it. The elevator carried us downward, dropping us so fast I thought my feet might lift up off the floor for a moment. When the car opened, we stepped out into a narrow service tunnel lined with wires and metal tubing. I followed my father down its length, nearly sprinting to keep up. It was a very long tunnel with a steep downward grade. When we finally reached the other end, my father opened a circular hatch in the ceiling with yet another security code. After a short climb up a metal ladder, we emerged into a large circular room with a clear domed ceiling. It provided a stunning view of the surrounding crater and of the armored sphere that was Moonbase Alpha, visible off to our right. A giant armored orb nestled into the adjacent goblet-shaped crater high above us, just beyond the lip of the larger bowl-shaped Daedalus crater in which we now stood. "Welcome to Daedalus Observatory," my father said. "Sorry about all the dust and trash. The cleaning drones never come down here, obviously. They closed the observatory down over 2 decades ago and made the whole place off limits." I spent a moment gazing out at the barren lunar surface, which stretched to the black horizon in all directions. The sight suddenly drove home the fantastic isolation of the place. It was no wonder my father and his friends behaved a bit strangely. The years of solitude they'd had to endure up here probably would have driven a lot of people nuts. "You said this place was off limits?" "It was," he said. "It is. But I figured out how to get the power and life support systems in here back online without alerting anyone back on Earth. And I left all of the hidden microphones and cameras in here disabled. So this is one of the few places in the entire base where the EDA can't monitor or record me." He leaned toward a small microphone stock protruding from a nearby security console and then spoke into it loudly. "Open the pod bay doors, Hal," he recited. I said, "Please open the pod bay doors, Hal." He grinned at me. "See? Sweet, sweet privacy." "Right, we wouldn't want the cigarette-smoking man to eavesdrop on us," I muttered. But he ignored the remark. "Here," he said, reaching over to flip a bank of switches, flooding the dim space with flickering fluorescent light. "This is what I wanted to show you." The other side of the control room was a chaotic, cluttered mess. Handwritten notes, diagrams, drawings, and computer printouts were taped up everywhere and stacked on every available surface. It looked like the lair of a homicide detective on some TV show, one who had spent decades tracking a serial killer no one else believed existed. I crossed the room and walked through the paper jungle my father had created, studying his notes and printouts. "I know how all this stuff must look," he said, as if he'd read my mind. "Like Russell Crowe's garage in A Beautiful Mind, right?" "I was thinking it looked more like a supervillain's lair," I said. I started punching random buttons on the console in front of me. "Which one of these is the self-destruct?" "The first one you pressed, actually," he said, pointing to an unlabeled red button. I believed him for a split second, long enough for my eyes to widen in panic. "Yes!" he said, grinning. "Got you, kid. Fine, you got me, I said. You did all this yourself? He nodded. I've never shared any of this with either Shin or Graham, he said. Shin wouldn't take any of it seriously, he said. And Graham... Well, Graham doesn't have a very skeptical way of thinking, and I wanted to approach this scientifically. He locked eyes with me. But from what you said up in the mess hall before, I was sure you didn't want to hear any of this. I shook my head. I've been asking myself the same questions you and Graham mentioned. I just didn't think learning the answers could make any difference now. I locked eyes with him. Tell me, I said. He nodded and took a deep breath. You know who Finn Arbogast is, he said. It wasn't a question, but I nodded. The fake founder of Chaos Terrain, I said, recalling my brief meeting with the man that morning at Crystal Palace, a lifetime ago. What about him? I was his primary military consultant when he and the Chaos Terrain team were developing Terra Firma and Armada, as well as all of the early mission packs, he said, and I thought I detected a tinge of pride in his voice. I always dreamed of making video games for a living when I grew up, so you can imagine how I felt when I got the chance to help design the video games that might save the world. Arbogast and I collaborated for several months, not in person, but we video conferenced several times a week. It was his job to create the video games that would train the world's population how to fight off the Europans. So his training simulations had to be able to simulate their ships, weapons, maneuvers, and tactics, all with a very high degree of accuracy. To accomplish that, they gave Arbogast unrestricted access to all of the EDA's data on the Europans, everything we'd learned about them since we made first contact. He sighed heavily. And I managed to access some of that classified data. How? I asked, when you were stuck up here and he was back on Earth. He linked his computer network to ours, my father said, so that he could share new builds of Terra Firma and Armada with us as soon as they were ready for testing. That allowed me to gain access to his research files on the Europans, which contained a lot of the top secret data about our interactions with them over the years, and everything I learned from them confirmed the theory I'd already been forming for almost a decade. I nodded, trying to hide how nervous he was making me. Lay it on me, I said. Okay, he said. Here goes. He took a deep breath. Ever since we made first contact with them, the aliens have been intercepting our movies and television broadcasts. Then they edit clips from them together and transmit them back to us, once a year, just prior to the Jovian opposition, he told me. But only a handful of people have ever been allowed to see the transmissions. He motioned to the screen. Now I need you to see them too. A barrage of these alien-edited video clips began to appear on the screen, and every last one of them depicted some form of human conflict. I glimpsed a lot of World War II newsreel footage, intercut with photos and video of the dozens of other large-scale military conflicts that had occurred in the following decades. But these images of real-life war were intercut with scenes from a lot of old war movies and television series. It almost seemed as if the Europans were unable to differentiate between reality and fiction. Either that, or they were intercutting the two on purpose in an effort to make some kind of point. Even weirder, I also began to spot brief scenes taken from dozens of science fiction films, all of them featuring hostile alien invaders of some kind. In the space of just a few seconds, I spotted shots from various films in the Trek and Wars franchises, mixed with shots from the various versions of War of the Worlds, The Day the Earth Stood Still, V, and even, God help us, Battlefield Earth. Nothing from the friendly alien movie genre, though. Not so much a single glimpse of E.T., Starman, Earth to Echo, or ALF. Look at these transmissions, he said, as the barrage of clips continued to flash on the screen, showing a grotesque menagerie of extraterrestrial invaders plucked from the entire history of science fiction films. Aliens, predators, triffids, transformers, you name it. These images, and the way in which they're arranged. I think it's some kind of a message, son, he said. An intentionally cryptic one. It's like they're holding up a mirror so that we can see ourselves from their perspective. The rapid montage of unsettling imagery flashing on the screen suddenly segued into a series of 2- and 3-second long clips from summer blockbusters like Independence Day, Armageddon, and Deep Impact, most of them from scenes that depicted all of humanity uniting as one species to save itself and its home from a deadly comet, a rogue asteroid, or from a wide variety of hostile alien invaders. I think the Europans have been studying us and our popular culture since before we even made first contact with them, my father said, raking his hands through his hair. I think they watched all of the science fiction films and television shows we've made that depict an alien invasion of our planet, and they realized it was one of our species' worst nightmares. So they set about making it happen. They proceeded to stage an alien invasion just like the ones we'd always imagined. The kind depicted in our fiction, complete with giant motherships, starship dogfights, killer robots, all of it. My father stared at me, waiting for me to say something, but I was momentarily speechless. I could only continue to stare at the screen where the images kept coming. I spotted stills from the reboots of The Thing, The Day the Earth Stood Still, and War of the Worlds, and then a clip from an older film, Earth versus the Flying Saucers. I knew for certain these transmissions were intended to be some sort of message when I heard this, he said, tapping his QCOM. Each of these bursts of images ends with a series of 5 tones. It was the opening of Wild Signals from John Williams' score for Close Encounters of the Third Kind. The 5 tones the government has their keyboardists start off with when they play that epic game of Simon with the aliens at the end of the movie. La, 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 bum, bum. The tones sounded as if they were coming from an old touch-tone push-button telephone handset. They began to play very quickly on a repeating loop. Then my father muted the audio and turned to study my reaction. But hearing those 5 notes from Close Encounters had momentarily thrown me off balance. I'd never liked that film, probably because of how easy it was for the main character, Roy Neary, to, spoiler alert, leave his family at the very end of the film. It hit a little too close to home. I stared at the images. I listened to the tones. I waited for him to continue. Okay, he said, inching forward. First, just think about the chronology of events. Think about how our first contact with them went down. The Europans orchestrated this entire conflict. They lured and manipulated us into it. He narrowed his eyes. Why else would they slap a giant swastika on the surface of Europa? It was a trap, and we walked right into it, just like Admiral fucking Akbar. Under other circumstances, this might have made me laugh, but not then. So, he went on, humanity discovers this threatening message from an obviously non-human intelligence, placed in a spot where they knew humans would find it when our technology advanced to the stage where we were capable of sending probes to our outer solar system, sort of like the monolith buried on the moon in 2001. I nodded, not in agreement, but just to indicate I understood the reference. I'm sure I would have mentioned that I'd read his copy of The Sentinel, the short story by Arthur C. Clarke that served as the initial inspiration for 2001's Artifact Left Behind by Ancient Alien storyline. But internally, I was wondering if my father was experiencing confirmation bias, or observational selection bias, or One of those other biases I'd learned about in my AP psychology class. Maybe he was seeing patterns where none really existed. Then again, maybe not. The Europans must have known we wouldn't be able to resist sending a probe down to investigate its origin. And the moment we did, they suddenly declared war and their intention to kill off our entire species. According to the official story, the aliens never gave us a chance to explain our actions or negotiate with them. But they didn't kill us off right away, even though they clearly had the technological means of doing so. No, instead of attacking us, they lured us into some sort of weird arms race. Then they gradually let us close the technological gap between us and them over a 42-year period. And then, this year, they finally decide to invade. Why? Their behavior doesn't make any sense. Unless they're testing us. It's the only logical explanation. We're not talking about Vulcans here, I reminded him. You can't impose human logic on alien behavior, right? Why should anything they do make sense to us? Their culture and motives might be, you know, beyond our human understanding. My father shook his head. This human understands enough to know when he's being messed with, he said. These aliens have coaxed and manipulated us into this exact position for a reason. Maybe to elicit a reaction, or to put us in specific kinds of circumstances to see how we'll react to them, collectively, as a species. As a test? He nodded. Then he sat down abruptly without saying another word, like an attorney who had finished delivering his closing argument to a jury, and stared at me, apparently waiting for me to respond, his eyes darting back and forth feverishly, hanging on my reaction. What is it you think they're testing us on? To see how terrified they can make us? To see how difficult we are to kill or enslave? I don't know, son, he said, his voice still calm and even despite his expression. Maybe they wanted to see how our species would handle itself during an encounter with another intelligent species. A potentially hostile one? That's one of the classic tropes of science fiction. Aliens are always showing up to put humanity on trial. The day the Earth stood still, stranger in a strange land, have spacesuit will travel, and a bunch of different Star Trek episodes. The Europans might have a million different motives. On the 80s reboot of The Twilight Zone, there was this one episode called A Small Talent for War. I raised my hand to cut him off. But this isn't science fiction, General, I said, feeling as if I were the adult in this conversation, while he had assumed the role of the starry-eyed teenager who won't listen to reason. This isn't some Twilight Zone episode. It's real life, remember? Life imitates art, he said. And maybe these particular aliens do, too. He smiled at me. Does any of this feel like something that could happen in real life to you? Or do events seem to be unfolding the way they would in a story or a movie, perfectly timed for dramatic effect? He picked up a large whiteboard resting against a nearby console and tilted it toward me so that I could see the two hastily drawn diagrams on it. He'd drawn a picture of the Death Star from Star Wars on the left side and a sketch of the disruptor dodecahedron on the right. Both drawings were surrounded by arrows and notes that appeared to draw a comparison between the two, but it was hard to be sure because I couldn't read my father's handwriting to save my life. Take the disruptor, for example, he said. Why is it so difficult to destroy when we have no problem plowing through their other drones? Why not make all of their drones that hard to destroy? Because the disruptor is a level boss, that's why. He pointed to the whiteboard. The disruptor is their version of the Death Star. It's a huge, nearly indestructible doomsday weapon, but it has a small Achilles heel that will allow us to destroy it. He locked eyes with me. It's like they designed it that way, so that at least one pilot has to sacrifice themselves to destroy it. The shields only drop for a few seconds, just long enough for two perfectly timed core detonations to go off. Why would they engineer it that way unless it was on purpose? I nodded. I wondered the same thing, I confessed. No weapons designer or engineer would build something with such an arbitrary weakness, he said. The disruptor is more like something a video game developer would come up with to create a big challenge at the end of a level, a boss that requires a huge sacrifice to destroy, and then they send one, just one, to attack this base instead of sending it straight to Earth. Why? Because they wanted us to see how it worked. Then they let us destroy it. Maybe that was part of their test, to find out if humans are willing to make a heroic sacrifice to save their comrades, to see if our species actually behaves the way we portray ourselves in our books and movies and games. He stood back up and began to pace, faster and faster. They could be testing us to see if humanity lacks the courage of its convictions. Are we as selfless and noble as we think we are? But how would the aliens even know about Vance's heroic sacrifice, I asked, or about anything that was going on within the EDA's ranks during those battles? He bit his lower lip. Then he held up his QCOM. Think about it. Where did this QCOM tech come from? I shook my head, not wanting to believe it, but he nodded in disagreement. The Europans invented this technology, and we barely even understand how it works, he said. For all we know, they're using these to eavesdrop on us right now. He rubbed his temples, wincing. I mean, do you think it was a coincidence that of all the EDA sites around the world they could have attacked this morning, they chose the one where we just relocated all of our elite recruit candidates? He fell silent and stared at me. My head was spinning. I sat down in one of the leather chairs bolted to the floor. Why are you telling me all this? I asked. He frowned, looking disappointed that I needed to ask. Because you're my son, he said. Maybe I just want to get your opinion. On what, General? On what you think we should do, he said. Do we ignore everything about the Europans' actions that don't add up and let the EDA launch their doomsday weapon at them? Try to commit genocide against the first intelligent species we've ever contacted? But they're coming here to commit genocide against us, I shouted. We have no choice but to defend ourselves. I believe we do, son. I think that's what they're doing, presenting us with a choice. We can try to destroy them, thereby ensuring that they destroy us, he said. Or we can take a gamble, based on our deductions and our moral reasoning, and try to stop the icebreaker. But then, won't we just be allowing them to wipe us out when they arrive? If they wanted to exterminate humanity, they could have done it decades ago, he said. They had the technological capability to wipe us out the day we made first contact with them. The illusion that we can defeat them in this war is just that, an illusion. It always has been. I didn't respond. He took me by the shoulders. No one else knows all of this. No one else could read these tea leaves like you and me, Zach. I feel like there must be a reason the two of us are here right now. We're in a position to decide the fate of humanity. He smiled. Maybe it's destiny. I stared into his eyes. He was telling me the truth, or what he believed to be the truth. There was no doubt in my mind of that. It's impossible to have a poker face with someone who has the same face as you. This is why you didn't participate in that first icebreaker mission, wasn't it? I asked. The Admiral benched you, didn't he? He thought you might try to sabotage it. He nodded. He knows me well, he said. We were friends a long time. You shared this theory with Admiral Vance, I said, and he didn't buy it? Archie is a good man, fearless, honorable. But the guy doesn't have much of an imagination, he said. and he doesn't know shit about common tropes in science fiction, he grinned. Take his call sign, Viper. He borrowed that from Tom Skerritt's character in Top Gun, his all-time favorite movie. He hates science fiction. I could never get him to watch Trek, Wars, Firefly, or BSG. He shook his head. The bastard even refused to watch E.T. Who doesn't love E.T., I ask you? Yeah, the man obviously can't be trusted, I muttered. My father frowned at my sarcasm. That's not what I meant, he said. Archie is a fighter at heart. He believes we can beat them, despite their superior technology, because evolution has better equipped us for warfare. He shook his head. I'm a gamer, Zach, like you. When I find myself confronted with a puzzle, I can't help but try to solve it. He began to pace back and forth in front of me again. I want to find out what the Europans really are. What's really down there under all that ice? He looked up through the dome at the bright band of stars overhead. I want to know the truth. I want to reach the end of the game. He turned to lock eyes with me once again. And I want to save the world, if I can. How? I'm not sure, he said. But I'm going to try, if I get the opportunity. He looked at the floor. And I wanted to explain myself to you first, so you'll understand any actions I may be forced to take. He shrugged. Maybe you can explain them to your mother if I don't get the chance. He trailed off. I was too frightened of what he might say to ask him to elaborate. When it became clear to him that I wasn't going to say anything more, my father reached out and pressed his hand to the scanner beside the exit. The door hissed open. It's a lot to process, he said. I'll give you some privacy to think it all through. He took a step forward, as if to hug me, but something in my eyes made him change his mind. He smiled and stepped back. I'm going to head back down to the Thunderdome and run a final systems check on each of the control pods, he said. Meet me there whenever you're ready, okay? I nodded, but remained silent. He gave me another forced smile, then disappeared through the exit. Once he was gone, I sat there alone in the darkened Daedalus Observatory control room, at the center of the giant electronic ear that humanity had constructed to try to communicate with its enemy, thinking about everything my father had just told me. What if he was right about this? Just like he'd been right all those years ago, when he scribbled down his theory about the Earth Defense Alliance in that old notebook of his. That theory of his had seemed ridiculous at first, too. I let the possibility linger in my thoughts for a moment. Then I cast one last glance up through the dome at the starry dynamo stretched out over my head, taking it all in. Then I turned and hurried out the exit, fleeing the solitude of the Daedalus Observatory as quickly as I could. There wasn't much time left. I didn't feel like spending any more of it alone. 19. I rode the turbo elevator back up to the observation deck. The moment the elevator doors swished open and I stepped into the large domed room, the odor of burning cannabis filled my nose. The smell grew increasingly stronger the farther I ventured into the room, as did the familiar strains of Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, punctuated by fits of only slightly suppressed laughter. In the dim light, I could now make out two figures sprawled out on the floor across the room. Shin and Milo were side by side, lying flat on their backs, staring up through the observation dome at the glowing band of the Milky Way above. They were passing a cruise missile-sized joint back and forth. The Pink Floyd was cranked up so loud they hadn't heard me come in, so I stood there eavesdropping for a few minutes while they continued a giggle-filled discussion of their favorite Robotech episodes. I tiptoed up behind them, then loudly cleared my throat. What's up, fellas? Shin scrambled to his feet, looking mortified, but Milo barely even reacted. "Zack," Shin said, turning red. "We didn't hear you come in." He turned to point a finger at his companion. "I was, showing Milo some of the things we grow in our hydroponic garden, and, "Now you're getting stoned out of your gourds," I said, "while listening to Dark Side of the Moon?" I motioned to the crater's surface out beyond the dome, stretching to the horizon in all directions around us. "On the far side of the moon?" "This is a special strain of Yoda Kush that I myself created," Shin said, holding up his giant spliff. "I thought it might help relax his nerves." Then he took a long hit and inhaled deeply. "Poor Milo is really stressed out, aren't you?" Milo shook his head. "Not anymore," he said, grinning wide. "Zack, you won't believe this shit." With some effort, he sat up, then turned to face me. "Shin told me that the EDA spent decades engineering a special strain of weed that helps people focus and enhances their ability to play video games. Once they had it perfected, that was when the government finally started legalizing it in the States." He raised his arms in victory. "This ganja is part of the war effort! I love it!" He broke into song and Shin immediately joined him. "America! Fuck yeah! Coming to save the motherfucking day! Yeah!" They broke up into another laughing fit. "Where are the others?" I asked.
"They all snuck off to bone each other," Milo announced. "Wody and Chen slipped away first, then Debbie snuck off with Graham."
I had no idea how to respond to this information.
"I can't say I blame them," Milo said. "We were all facing the possibility of imminent death. Why not throw caution to the wind and go out with a bang?" "So to speak."
"I was just thinking the same thing," Shin said, turning to smile down at him. The two of them made eyes at each other for a few seconds until my clueless ass finally figured out what was going on. As my mother was often fond of pointing out to me, my gaydar was just plain broken. "I'll see you guys later," I said, backing toward the exit. "I'm just gonna, you know," I nodded over my shoulder, "let you guys have some privacy." Shin grinned at me, amused at how flustered I'd become all of a sudden. "Thanks, Zack," he said.
"Yeah, thanks, dude," Milo called after me, laughing. "We could use the privacy."
As I rode the lift down to the Thunderdome, I found myself wondering where Lex was and what she was doing. Had she too found some handsome stranger to spend her last moments with, while I waited mine out, alone up here, a million miles away? 1 hour, 33 minutes, 43 seconds remaining. When I reached the Thunderdome, I didn't think there was anyone else there at first. Then the canopy of one of the drone controller pods slid open, and my father climbed out of it. He smiled at me, but I turned away as soon as our eyes met and walked over to one of the other pods. Just as I was beginning to lower myself into it, my father crouched at the edge of the oval-shaped pit and looked down at me. "I'm sorry, Zack," he said. "I shouldn't have dumped all of that on you. It was too much after everything else you've been through today." "It's okay," I said. "Thanks for listening," he said. "You're a good listener, just like your mom." He looked away. "I've been waiting for a long time to talk with you about all that." He trailed off. I lifted my eyes to meet his gaze, but didn't respond. "Aren't you going to say anything?" he asked. I shook my head. "I'm still trying to process all of it," I replied. "I don't know what to believe." He nodded. I hit the button to close my control pod's canopy. It slid shut between us, ending the conversation, or at least postponing it temporarily. I sat in my simulated cockpit with my eyes closed, trying to collect my thoughts. I didn't have much luck. Sometime later, I heard my father greet Debbie, Chen, and Wody, Milo, Shin, and Graham a few minutes after that. When the countdown clock hit the one-hour mark, we all gathered in front of the command station to watch the President of the United States address the nation from the Oval Office on live television. She smiled reassuringly at the camera, but the fear in her eyes was evident. "My fellow Americans," she began. "At this very moment, the leaders of every nation around the world are about to show their citizens the same briefing film I'm about to show you, which will explain the alarming situation that now faces all of humanity." Debbie was standing nearby, staring down at her QCOM display, waiting for the moment when she could finally call her boys, but our phones were still locked. I glanced over at Chen, Shin, and Graham, who were each focused on other, smaller display screens mounted nearby, the ones that showed the leaders of their respective countries making a similar introduction. A second later, the faces of the U.S. and Chinese presidents and of the Japanese and British prime ministers vanished from the display screens, and the Earth Defense Alliance logo appeared on each of them.
"In 1973, NASA discovered the first evidence of a non-terrestrial intelligence right here in our very own solar system," Sagan's voiceover began. "When the Pioneer 10 spacecraft sent back the first close-up photograph of Europa, Jupiter's fourth largest moon."
The eight of us stood there, clustered together in a tight knot, and re-watched the entire film, this time with the knowledge that the rest of humanity was seeing it too. When the film ended, the president's face reappeared, and she told the world what Admiral Vance had told all of us at Crystal Palace earlier that morning, which now felt like an entire lifetime ago. Once the president finished revealing the bad news about the approaching alien armada, the networks began replaying her address, with increasingly alarming headlines superimposed across the screen, along with footage showing the stunned and panicked reactions of average people. As I watched the chaos unfold in the array of video windows before me, I thought about my mother and my friends and everyone else trapped down there. Would the EDA's plan really work? Would our civilization collapse in the wake of the revelation that we were about to be invaded by aliens? Or had the EDA subconsciously prepared us enough to deal with it, as they'd hoped? Would humanity cower in fear or stand its ground and fight back? I stared at the screens, wondering which one it would be. Shin pulled up dozens of different television networks from all over the world and displayed them on the dome side by side, along with more video feeds from the internet. We watched as the initial wave of panic spread across the globe, footage of people freaking out on crowded city streets and stampeding out of sports stadiums. But the world seemed to take the news incredibly well. If there were riots, mass suicides, and lootings going on, no one was reporting them, or even posting videos of them online. Within minutes, it seemed like the same newscasters who had delivered the news were now reporting with total confidence that most of the world's civilian population was already responding to the EDA's call to arms, and that hundreds of millions of people all over the world were already mobilizing themselves by logging on to the EDA's online operations servers to enlist and then receive their combat drone assignments and take up arms and defend the planet. Several networks were showing clips of people abandoning their cars in traffic to run into electronics stores and libraries and coffee shops and internet cafes and office buildings, thousands upon thousands of people, all in a mad dash to get somewhere with broadband internet access. There was no way the news networks could have pulled together all that footage so quickly and then edited it together for broadcast. And at this stage, it would be impossible to know whether or not a majority of the world's population was prepared to join the Earth Defense Alliance and fight to defend our home. This had to be the EDA at work, convincing media outlets that our best chance at survival was to tell the reassuring lie. And they were right. If people believed that humanity was already uniting itself under the EDA's banner, they were far more likely to join the fight themselves. I thought again of the note my father had scribbled in his notebook so long ago. What if they're using video games to train us to fight without us even knowing it? Like Mr. Miyagi in The Karate Kid, when he made Daniel-san paint his house, sand his deck, and wax all of his cars. He was training him, and he didn't even realize it. Wax on, wax off, but on a global scale.
30- and 60-second-long public service announcements began to run amid the news bulletins, each designed to inform the world's civilian population of the EDA's plan and show them how to use their computer or mobile device to enlist in the Earth Defense Alliance online and help save the world. The best PSA was one that opened with a shot of a brother and sister sitting on the couch in their living room. The boy is playing Armada on their giant television, while the girl sits beside him playing Terra Firma on her handheld tablet. On their screens, we can see that she's operating an AFID infantry drone, while he pilots a WASP quadcopter. Both of them are trying to take down a towering alien basilisk, stomping its way through a suburban neighborhood. On the TV screen, we see the behemoth lurch forward and step onto the corner of a house, crushing it under one of its massive metal feet. And at that same moment, the wall of the kid's living room also collapses, revealing that it was their house the giant robot just stepped on. The two kids aren't playing a game. They're defending their home. Their parents cower behind the couch, watching as their two children do battle with the giant alien machine with the help of hundreds of other drones operated by their neighbors. When the behemoth explodes under a hail of enemy fire, the parents whip out their smartphones and use them to take control of two more drones and join the battle, too. It reminded me of one of those old toy commercials that ended with the line, "And Mom and Dad can play along, too." When I couldn't bear to watch the news feeds any longer, I climbed into my control pod and closed the canopy, then made it non-transparent, creating my own private isolation chamber. I sat there in the darkness for a while, listening to myself breathe. Then I took out my QCOM and queued up a song I'd first discovered on one of my father's old mixtapes. It was a great rock instrumental by Pink Floyd that I'd often used to psych myself up before a big Armada mission. I'd played it over and over, each time mouthing the words to the single lyric spoken in the middle of the song. "One of these days, I'm going to cut you into little pieces." 1 hour, 0 minutes, 0 seconds remaining. When the countdown clock showed only 1 hour remaining, all of our QCOMs beeped in unison. A notice on my display told me that the EDA had finally unlocked our QCOMs' access to the public phone system. Graham, Debbie, Wody, Milo, and Chen each climbed into their individual drone controller pods and then closed their canopies to give themselves some privacy for their calls home. Shin didn't call anyone. Instead, he picked up his bass guitar and, in what seemed like an odd coincidence, he began to play a solo version of One of These Days while staring up at the stars projected on the dome over our heads. Then, I noticed a practice set list taped to the floor in front of him, and saw that several of the songs listed there were tracks I knew from my father's old mixtapes. My father was off by himself, too, sitting at the command center console. When I walked over to join him, I saw that he was staring at my mother's contact information on his QCOM's display screen. "Are you going to call her?" I asked, making him jump slightly. He shook his head. "I was about to send her a video message instead," he said. "I recorded 23 takes of it, but they're all terrible, so maybe I'll just give up and send her the least terrible one." I plucked the QCOM out of his hand and began to dial a number. "Are you going to call her?" he asked, like a nervous schoolboy. "Right now?" I nodded. "I need to let her know I'm okay," I said. "And before you send her some psychotic video message, I should probably break the news to her that you're alive first. Otherwise, she'll have a coronary when your face pops up on her iPhone." My father gave me a relieved smile, but before he could reply, we were interrupted by Milo's voice coming from his nearby pod. When he'd climbed inside, he must have forgotten to close his canopy all the way,
and now we could hear every word of his conversation.
Ma, it's going to be okay, Milo said. You know how they've been training everyone to fight with video games? Well, I'm one of the best Armada pilots in the world. And so that's why they recruited me early.